It's hard not to add a side of hot, crispy hash browns to your favorite McDonald's breakfast. It's even harder not to eat said hash browns before you get home. Ba-da-ba-ba-ba.
Hey, welcome to IKEA, where even this desk is circular.
Huh. How so? Looks pretty rectangular to me.
It's because we're always looking to repair, reuse, and relove our products, like buying back your IKEA items for store credit. Or shop our as-is section for great deals. You can even order free spare parts. Get on the circular path for a more sustainable future.
Still a rectangle.
Get started at ikea-usa.com/circular. Visit ikea-usa.com/circular for as-is information and buyback and resale terms and conditions. Spare parts not available for all products.
Welcome to this special episode of Jimmy's Jobs of the Future. It was recorded in front of a live audience. The guests were Harry Cole, the political editor of The Sun, and James Heal, the political correspondent of The Spectator. They are perhaps most famous for having written the book Liz Truss Out of the Blue. It became so wildly popular that it became a meme in the year she became Prime Minister. We spoke to them all about what it was like writing the book and how the job of being a political journalist is changing in such a fast-moving environment. Politics and business at times can be very serious. The whole point of these evenings is that they are due to be a bit more lighthearted. We kick off with a bit of comedy from yours truly at the beginning, but it's also mixed in with some searing insight to how our politics and media is changing. If you're interested in coming to future live events, then make sure you sign up to our Substack, which is in the show notes below. That will be where we release information first.
Thank you very much. Popular culture since the start of the year has collided with politics on a scale as we've seen with Mr. Bates versus Post Office. And of course, Paula Venables has had to give back her CBE. And it made me think, what's the actual process for that? Do the beef eaters march around from Buckingham Palace, or does she have to go and pop it through the letterbox? Or does she have to go to the post office? Would you like that insured? Is it fragile? That'll be £252, please. It's just what the computer says. You are the only one. It gives me great pleasure to welcome two people to the stage who probably aren't going to have to worry about handing back their CBEs anytime soon. Harry Cole and James Heal.
Thank you, Jimmy.
Jimmy, that was genuinely funny.
I'm so surprised. Harry very kindly retweeted my standard put out earlier in the year, seeing by so many thousands of people because you're so big on Twitter. But anyway, enough about me. What I want to know about is the book, and I've been dying to ask you this, and I haven't seen either of you recently. Who approached who about the book to start, and when were you approached, and what was happening in Tory politics at the time?
James is going to tell the outrageous allegation that I was drunk. But
it was a quite literal approach. I was at the Chez Antoinette popular watering hole in Westminster, Victoria, and you came over after a couple of bottles, and you said, let's write the book. We always discussed doing a book at the Mail on Sunday, and then the pandemic intervened. But we were talking about Keir Starmer at the time, that he said, you know, this is August 2022, Liz Truss is clearly going to win the leadership race. It's 2 weeks to go. Let's write the book. And I think August 15th, we started it. And I think we sort of signed the contract 5 days later. And we wrote it, and 65 days later, she was out of power and we filed the book that day.
It was, I mean, everyone sort of takes a piss and says, oh God, did you have to rewrite it? Yeah. We didn't really. We changed a few tenses, but it was more, we just kept going. And HarperCollins were absolutely amazing on that front because they led us basically. They let us just kind of, they turned it around so quickly. They were sort of editing bits of it as it was going along. But they just kept pushing and pushing and pushing the deadline back. And then there was that sort of crucial tipping moment of thinking, you know, the worst case scenario, I think,
would have been if she had sort of survived long enough for the book to come out, and then while it was literally at the printers, resigned. Or but we in the end, it was, you know, we were always wondering where to end it. We were going to end it at the party conferences.
Yes.
We added 10 more days onto it, and that was that.
I think the very, very last date physically where we could have got it done would be October 31st. So she gave us a week to go. She left office, and then we managed to get it over the line.
I think she filed it on the day then.
Yeah, the last day. And I think actually the best bit was obviously 4 days previously, because she resigns on the Thursday, and then she actually goes on the Tuesday. On the Thursday, we met with the publicist.
Yeah, we were literally in a pub talking about the, you know, the book, media plan for the book. And I was thinking, oh, it's looking bad. But, you know, this was about 1 o'clock. And it was a sort of one of those moments when we sort of look up at the telly in the pub and went, uh-oh. Finish a Guinness and back to Westminster. I mean, that speed of that day was just insane.
And when did you think, oh, God, is it screwed? And then thinking, because it ended up winning Sunday Times Political Book of the Year, and it is a superb read. I mean, it could be called How to Climb the Greasy Pole, right? Like, it's extraordinary kind of those years in Westminster. So when did you think, oh, actually, we're going to benefit from this, the fact that it's all coming to an end incredibly quickly?
I think there was, I remember James getting a bit, I was quite amused by it.
Because you want to do your day, your political editor of the Sun.
Yeah. And it was sort of, we put out that the book was coming out, and it was about Liz Truss's, and we could argue about the word extraordinary, but it was an extraordinary rise to power. And then, so we put the original title out, which then about 2 weeks later, I think we started to think, well, this isn't looking too good. So we changed the sort of subdeck of the title, and they re-released it on sort of Amazon. And so there was a sort of bubbling piss-taking trend on Twitter, which James won't mind me saying now, that you were getting quite annoyed about. And I was just thinking, this is fine. This is going to be fine. I was kind of telling myself, this is going to be fine. Better to be talked about than not to be talked about. It's good, natural buzz, PR. But Keir Starmer stood up at PMQs, and literally, I think, what would he say? He said, there's a book about the Prime Minister, and we promise it's out by Christmas. We're not sure whether that's the Prime Minister or the book. I always thought,
Starmer,
you can't pay, you cannot pay for PR like that. Like, yeah, yeah, yeah. the only bit of the week where anyone actually watches PMQs. And not only that, the first question for the leader of the opposition is probably the most watched moment in British politics of the week. And yeah, he did it. So he signed a copy for him, sent it to him, and
it's a free beer.
Thanks for the spin.
I think the actual story is you ambushed him at the lobby drinks.
There's a lot of ambushing.
You read up out the night, branching his copy of the book.
A lot of ambushing.
How did it feel becoming a bit of a meme, James? Like, because it was all the people sending around pictures, sort of, you know, 50% off, 70% off.
Yeah, take it. Just please, God, take it.
The best was the meme, which is on LinkedIn, which was like, if you're having a bad day at work, at least you're not Harry Cole or James Heal.
Yeah, that motivational guy, Californian speaker, made us an entire, like...
Part
of his pitch. Like, it could be worse. Your dreams are dead, but at least you're not these guys.
And it got shared 30,000 times. And my bemused father was sending it to me. It's like, my colleagues are sending me this. What is this meme thing? My sister was getting, like, sort of joked about it at university. It was bizarre. And yeah, and I had, like, on the day that she went, I had the Spiegel try and get in touch in a very sort of thick German accent. They were like, you are an international laughingstock. How does that feel? Like, very, very deadpan German. Yeah. They were getting mocked by the Germans, you know.
And the levels of research, I'm going to direct this question at James.
what is the implication of that?
Was extraordinary. I mean, you've got things like her graduate results from Shell and so on. Like, how do you go about putting a book together like that in that time?
Well, I think the first 20,000 words were easy. It was the 20 to 40,000. That was the kind of hard bit where you kind of had plotted it out like a sort of glorified Wikipedia page, and you'd written it on Google Doc. And that was the middle bit, trying to fill in those kind of years where not much was written about her. And so a lot had been written about her at a young age in Leeds, growing up there. And then a lot had been written about her kind of post-2019, when she became a really big player in the party. But those kind of middle year, particularly trying to go around the selections and stuff, I think one of the interesting things was looking at selections. So in the late 2000s, she obviously was involved in a high profile selection battle, and her kind of going around the different country and all the different constituencies. Local newspaper archives were a great...
Student newspaper archives as well were...
Oh my God, yeah.
Absolute crackers. Right.
Yeah, yeah.
James, so when I first met James, when we were both at the Mail on Sunday, and he was a bushy, very enthusiastic graduate who...
we would basically get to do all the research on stories. I mean, I'll come in and write a nice headline and write a nice tidy intro on it. But James had his ability to find random shit about people from, and the thing about politicians especially is you don't get to be in the cabinet at 38 unless you've been a weirdo at university. So, and the thing about sort of, you know, Oxford in the 80s, in the 90s, UCL, Edinburgh, they all have really, 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 really good student newspapers.
Yeah.
And they're all archived. And so a couple of days at Oxford, the other thing you did, and then UCL, and you know, and it's just there. It's just, it was just all there. It was a matter of just going through it. And that's where James's skill set is, particularly the patience to go through that stuff. Well,
the other thing was doing some interviews, and I had to transcribe them. And I remember some of Harry's interviews involved a couple of glasses. And so I had these sort of, you know, headphones pressed to my ear trying to transcribe it. And some of the later conversations, you would sometimes go off on tangents. I remember talking about, this, can we get some more breadsticks? Can we get some more breadsticks to the table?
Which actually made it into a quote in the book. I was reading the quote in the book. I just looked at it and went, why are they talking about breadsticks? I was like, oh, wait, hang on. That was an interview. Yeah. No, but that was the way, because the speed we worked in it as well. And we do have, conflicting, actually very, work very complementary skill sets. But there was a time, because just the speed at which we had to get stuff done, especially the pre 2019 trust stuff, that middle section that Jane talks about. So talking to people that, and we used Otter basically, but I would literally be in a bar in Mayfair talking to a contact, and James would be almost sort of transcribing it as the conversation happened and pulling the stuff out. And it's a remarkable way. We did a lot of interviews. If we were not having things like Otter and apps like that, we would have taken months and months and months.
What was extraordinary about this book as well was doing it in August, and the kind of hubris, the confidence of many of the people around Liz Truss. It's going to be great. We're going to do all these things that these, you know, losers like David Cameron haven't been able to do because they're too scared, etc. And then watching that kind of transform in 8 weeks into kind of October, and just ashen-faced people talking to us as it all fell apart was incredible to watch.
Watching her as well, in terms of, we did two interviews with Truss herself, and on one very much on the up at evening, where and this is again where James's encyclopedic knowledge was hilarious, because she basically stopped halfway through and said, "You know my life better than I do." he was picking her up on dates of things that happened in her life.
Yeah, yeah.
To the point it got a bit weird. And then I do have to admit that I did throw James under the bus.
You reversed the bus.
There was a couple of key details that we did kind of wanted to know. Things like her A-level results, when she first started dyeing her hair blonde, things like that, but you know, you don't really want to have that conversation with anyone. And so we sort of agreed what we'd do is that, you know, we'd do our interview, do all the sort of, you know, and then at the end, just do a couple of, you know, ones that are going to be a bit awkward in. But we sort of forgot. And then I was like, James, I think you have a few more questions to ask, don't you? A couple of points to. And then he just was sort of machine gunned her with these like incredibly personal questions. I said, like, why are you doing that? Bloody hell.
No, it's all like, oh, James has got a question. And the Prime Minister, Director of Comms at number 10, were like, watch. And I was like, Prime Minister, when did he dye your hair blonde? Truly holding power to account.
Can you just hold the mics a bit close to you?
Sorry,
it's all right. It's the audio producers will go crazy. And how was the tension? I mean, you touched on slightly that you're not competitors, and obviously you write rest and publications, but more like when you're in those archives and so on, you know, you're sort of diary editor of the Spectator. Like, how much do you have to kind of hold back for the book and think, oh God, this would be such a brilliant diary story at this particular moment as well? How do you manage that tension?
Well, I think I had a very supportive editor, and all the team at the Spectator were brilliant while it was lasting. And I think they kind of accepted that, you know, we'd have this new Prime Minister, it'd be best to know as much as possible about her. And so it's kind of taking a longer term approach. But I think that, you know, by writing for slightly different audiences and for being different points in our career, you know, I worked with Harry when I was at the Mail on Sunday, as he said, I was a graduate. I think on the day one you started, he started 2 weeks after me. I tried to take him out of the building, got completely lost. He was like, you've no idea where we're going. I was like, absolutely. But yeah, and so I think, I mean, there was some stuff I sort of reported beforehand, but I think often talking to people, they wanted their stories told in the book. They were like, this is for the book, this is for posterity. And that was kind of, okay. You know, you have to take what their word for that.
I sort of cut a deal with the Sun that, look, I'm going to need a couple of weeks off for this. Actually,
it's fine, not much happening.
No, we're actually the Queen, the death of the Queen, I don't think if that hadn't happened in a strange way, I don't think we would have got the book finished, right, because politics just stopped for 10 days. And you know, our royal team kicked in and took over, which allowed me to basically work from home for 10 days, doing a couple of hours a day on the paper and the rest, which is another 22 hours of the day on the book. So if that hadn't happened, but then the sort of terms that I was able to write it on was, look, you know, this is the sort of book that we would probably buy a serialization for, doing it in-house. Yeah. So like, I sort of backloaded it. And then once the book came out, we did, you know, we sort of serialized it within the News UK family and the Times, Sunday Times and the Sun.
And when did you think, so you're watching this incredible kind of like rise of the Truss and Trussites, when did you think this is not going to fly? Is it going to crash?
I think it was, for me, it was the day we interviewed the day after the mini budget. And it was the Friday was the mini budget. The Saturday we went and saw her and she was just completely oblivious to how it had all landed. And that's when I think the warning sign started to
go. Yeah, we were sitting in the car literally outside. And she was still at Chevening.
Because was having work done.
Chequers was having work done. So the Prime Minister, as Prime Minister, was still using the Foreign Secretary's house. And obviously you got the security and all the gates and stuff. So we were a bit early, actually. And so we just pulled up, in the tiny little hamlet that ran the corner. And we were just having a chinwag in the car. And then suddenly we just saw Truss, like sort of wandering towards us with like one copper and her kids. And they're off to go get coffee in a local pub. And she just had this sort of calm sereneness about her that was just, frankly, quite on reflection, fucking mental. But like, and we sort of said, like, you know, and she said, oh, everyone's being wet. Everyone needs to man up. You know, it's, you know, the pound will do what the pound does. You know, everyone just needs to calm down.
The last thing she said to me was, I'm not sure if I should put Richard Cobden in my conference speech. And I remember leaving thinking, no one's going to be talking about Richard Cobden when it comes to your conference speech, unfortunately.
And it was just this, yeah, this sort of, she has an incredibly thick skin, but almost to a point of lacking any sort of actually emotional intelligence. Mm-hmm. Because to not be able to see how bad it was that day and just be like, I'll be fine. Everything will be fine. Everything will be okay. That's when I really thought, oh, Christ, this is as bad as things. But the warning signs were there in the book. That's the thing. The reason I think we didn't really need to rewrite anything, and people, once they read the book, realize that actually it is a warning from history.
It reminds me of, to say quickly, it's the first time I met Liz Truss was actually with the Mail and Sun.
Was that when she was incredibly flirty?
That was the second time. But the first time was, it was Tory Conference 2018. I was with the Mail and Sunday team. And we had this, we were at this dinner, and it was her and her then spad, Larissa Chesterfield, who's now going to work for Sunak. And basically upstairs was the ports reception for like British sea shanty. They were chanting sea shanty songs. And they were doing like, what shall we do with a drunken sailor? And I remember like Glen Owen like trying to like have to shout questions as like dust was coming through the ceiling. And it reminds me very much of that tonight.
Yeah.
I like it. It's got a good background.
Right. We got all the clippable stuff about this Truss in the back, so it's fine. And what do you think's going to happen now in terms of, we've seen all the stuff with Popcorn this week, sort of battle for a Tory party, people saying afterwards, what do you guys think's going to happen with the general election? You had a great exclusive earlier this week that Sunak's now thinking of October rather than November.
Yeah, I think so. I think just if you're looking at the direction of travel that the West is going in, Trump looks like he's. I think okay, without getting too technical and boring, I think that there is an overcompensation on people's. Lots of people got it wrong in 2016 when Trump won, and now slightly overcompensating and saying, you know, doom laden predictions that he's definitely going to win. I think is a lot tighter than you would have it believe. But there is a large chance that geopolitics once again gets upended.
Yeah.
In November, and in all likelihood, it's going to be a Labour victory. And I think the way it was told to me was, you know, yes, it's obviously a decision entirely for the Prime Minister of when to go to the country, but I think some wiser hands and people have been around the block for a while, and people who's, you know, are paid to look out for our national interests, have basically said, look, you're probably going to lose. Do we really want? In the middle of, you know, whatever happens, you know, Trump, if Trump does win, you know, it's, you know, whatever happens around then, do we really want a new inexperienced Labour government coming in immediately when actually you could basically give them a month's head start to get bed in know, we are NATO, you know, two most important countries in NATO, two most important countries in G7, I'd argue, in terms of what's going on in Ukraine at the moment, what's going on in the Middle East, what's going on in the Red Sea. You know, you can't have both the UK and the US, you know, undergoing fundamental change. I think that that message has got through.
That's interesting. Well, I wrote a Substack piece at the start of the year saying that the US presidency wasn't going to have any impact on it. You've basically completely changed my mind. I want to dive a bit more into the jobs that you do, because I'm fascinated by director. I realize, James, you've been... Yeah, exactly. It's there. It's in the name. But you've been promoted recently to political correspondent as well.
Woohoo.
I knew you obviously started out sort of doing diaries as well. Yeah. What's the job with diary editor is a young 20-something in Westminster trying to get stories and so on. Like,
it used to be a really, really good way of basically subsidizing your lifestyle, because if you are doing, so I used to string for the Evening Standard diary back in the day, and you basically get to go to three different parties a night and live off of champagne and canapes, which sounds fun until about 6 months in. The last thing you ever want to do is eat one of those little tiny little Yorkshire puddings with the roast beef and then pull. But no, it's a sort of entry level gig. But in a weird way, I mean, if you look at sort of people who've done it, it's a very good way of basically, it teaches you a very good skill set of learning that nothing holds. Everything can be told in 40 words if you want it to be. And you don't need that 18th paragraph of quotes in a story to make it fun and pithy and interesting and good. So it's a very good way of tight, concise, fast-moving gossip stories. It's a very good training route to avoid writing boring stories.
And Twitter hasn't killed it?
Well, we're all bloggers now. We're all Twitter. I started out coming through the blogosphere, as they called it then. But now, you know, every single news, we're all bloggers now. Everything is almost online first. Twitter has killed it a little bit. You're never going to get an exclusive story off of Twitter, because by default, Twitter is a publisher. Once it's been published, it's out there. The story's out there. So I always say to anyone that works with me and anyone who asks for advice on coming through, get off Twitter. I'll say it a bit ruder. And get out, because it's not. You're never going to get an exclusive on with someone already written it.
Yeah.
Yeah. So being a diarist is enormous, good fun, great training. Basically, I started doing it at university. I remember I sort of caused a bit of an upset with the university press office because I sold a copy of my Chancellor Baroness Hale's speech at Bristol the week before the Miller verdict, the Supreme Court. So it was like, how the hell did the Times get a copy of this? So that was good fun. And I remember doing lots of in-person events. So I was, you know, had to chase poor Michael Caine around Somerset House a few years ago. What do you think of Brexit, Mr. Caine? That was good fun. I accidentally spilled a glass of wine on Naomi Campbell once at the Vogue 100 party. I know, my life flashed before my eyes. So basically, it was just like a really just good way of meeting people and having to try and, you know, strike up a conversation, get a story in 30 seconds or so.
The other thing about diaries is people never forget, ever. And I'll have people now that will come up to me and be like, in 2009, you wrote this about me. And I'm like, I've completely forgotten that, but you clearly haven't.
That's because it's about people on the way up as well.
That's why I think it was weirdly bringing it back to the book was quite... That 2010 election, when all of that gang came in, the Kwasis, the Ravs, the Trusses, the Priti Patels, you know, I arrived in the Westminster scene sort of 2009 time, and then that mob arrived in May 2010. So actually, in a weird way, we sort of start, like, they were all very new to it, I was all very new to it, and actually sort of slightly the tide came up.
Yeah.
And it's similar, well, not obviously, you know, obviously they've gone on to great things and in the cabinet and blah, 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 and I throw rocks from the sidelines. But, a lot of the contacts I had as a very junior reporter ended up going to be very senior people. So, but when we first met doing diary stories, and as James says, you know, trawling the pubs of Westminster, they were pretty junior as well.
And there's a line in the book that really stuck with me that you called the 2010 intake of Conservative MPs probably the best generation since 1916.
Sounds like a bit of a book James wrote.
I think it was 1950 we called it, yeah, or 1983, because that election had, you know, people like Heath and Maudley and MacLeod and Powell and all people who went off. I think Robert Carr was in that, I think, you know, who would then become the mainstays of the Tory cabinets of the 60s and 70s. And that 2010 intake, I believe, produced about 26 cabinet ministers, people who would sit around the cabinet table. And all of them, only one of them became prime minister, and that was Liz Truss. So a big part of this book was, how does she survive where others failed? You got cut down in the fray of Brexit and COVID. Others resigned. She never did. She never really threatened to resign. I think the only time she really thought about it was March 2019, when, frankly, who wasn't resigning from Theresa May's government. And so I think...
Andrew James.
Yeah. I'm sorry. A sort of haunted look descended over your eyes there. Oh, sorry. No. But yeah, no. And so why did she survive when others failed?
I did always have a theory that no one from the 2010 intake might end up being prime minister, because it would end up being a circular firing squad. But again...
It was because of the expenses crisis in 2009. There was the number of... We'll get a... I suspect we'll get a similarly large intake in the election when it comes, presumably October, on both sides. Because there's 55 Tory MPs now standing down. There's the natural churn of, you know, it's tea time in the cricket match, and it's the other guy's turn to bat. And then on the Labour side, they've actually had some pretty poor intakes under the Corbyn years. The 17 intake was pretty shocking. They only gained one seat in 2019, and then, you know, lots of the people that have come in have been, you know, the people are coming in by elections not being very impressive at all.
Do you think the standard of our politicians is dropping?
So I was talking about this the other night. It's a standard dropping, or we just
getting older,
or we getting older, or no, is it standard dropping, or is just accountability increasing? I think it. I mean, would there be duffer MPs in previous parliaments? Of course.
Yeah.
You know, is politics now a dirtier business and seedier and grubbier and more corrupt than ever before? I don't think it is. I just think the standards bar is much higher now, and stuff that 5, 10, 15 years when I started out at Westminster, people wouldn't have got away with.
Yes.
Would have got away with. Now, especially on the sex and bullying side of things, the game has completely changed. And so the reason we've got the record number of by-elections and number of MPs suspended, and the fact that the independents are now a larger block than the Lib Dems. I mean, there are more people suspended by the two main parties than there are Lib Dems in Parliament. So they technically, you know, if the SNP, you know, weren't there, they'd get a question at PMQs. Like, on behalf of the Nazis, I'd like to say. So it was, our standards higher. Yeah, definitely. I think everyone likes to think that the current crop of politicians are the worst ever, but, you know.
Who are some rising stars to kind of look out for on both Labour and Tory benches that we might not have come across yet?
Come on, James.
I think Laura Farris will be one to watch. I think she's one of the people who's actually going to be due to hold her seat. Her father was an MP as well, but she's been made a Home Office Minister. I think she's quite impressive on one of the Tory side. And then I think, you've got to look at Labour people who got promoted in the last reshuffle. So people like, she's been out of the airwaves because of obviously what's been happening in Gaza, but Shabana Mahmood, I think, is very impressive as Shadow Justice Secretary. But frankly, a lot of the ministers of the next Labour government, if that happens to be the case later this year, are being selected now, because I think the next intake is probably going to be more than 50% of the whole parliamentary party in Labour is going to be new MPs, backbenchers, new intake. And so it's going to be a whole new different type of parliament feel to it.
I once tweeted that I thought Darren Jones, when he was the chairman of the Business Select Committee, and it was quite a long time ago, sort of Diane Corbyn days. And I just tweeted that, you know, could this be Labour's next prime minister? He's now down in the shadow cabinet as chief secretary. He stopped me in the corridor about 3 days later and said, please don't ever tweet that again. It was incredibly unhelpful. The last thing any aspirational Labour politician under Corbyn needs to be is being tipped by the sun to... But on the Tory, I think what happened...
Darren Jones is very good, by the way.
Darren Jones, yeah. Oh, good. There we go. Darren Jones is very good. West Streeting, obviously, I think, has got a lot to offer if he can square off the unions. If he does become deeply unpopular as Labour Health Secretaries, which Labour's Health Secretaries tend to do. On the government side now, is the next Prime Minister, Tory Prime Minister, even elected yet? Possibly not. Is the next Tory Prime Minister someone you've never heard of? Almost certainly. I'd say my tip is the Exchequer Secretary, what's he called? Gareth Davies. I think he's a really impressive guy. Grantham, overdue an MP, PM from Grantham. But it depends what happens in the, you know, if the elections are closer than people think, and there's a sort of route back for the Tories in one go, if they can do it in 5 years, if they could, you know, then I think they might not go full mental. And and they might choose someone a bit more unifying. So it's someone like James Cleverly. But if it's the Tonking that it's looking like it's going to be, they're going to need a extended period of shouty crackers.
And you said that you don't become senior cabinet minister by the age of 38 without being weird at university. Some might say you don't become political editor of the Sun in your mid-30s, a similar age. But talk to us about the job. Like, obviously, you've got a big decision to make about declaration and stuff. I'm not expecting that as an exclusive.
No, sorry. I'll come back and talk about it. But,
you'll be the last to know. That's what I used to say to you when I was in number 10.
Yeah. please stop calling this number.
Talk to us about the job, Harry. I mean, you've spent your
It's amazing. So, I mean, look, I've, without being too sort of academic pompous, I came through on the wave of completely changing of how the media works, and the fact that, you know, we were selling 4 million copies, in 1997, and we're not selling that now. But we're doing more stuff. We're doing far more across multiple platforms, across video, across audio, across the website, on two sides of the pond now. Where before, the job of a political editor would be quite a civilized berth. So you'd be in for 10. Write a list in the morning and, then take lunch. Come back about 4, write some copy. My predecessor, Trevor Cavanagh, who did the job for 25 years, used to leave the office at 6. And this is a life change when he got a car phone, where he would basically drive back to his house in Epsom and dictate the copy down the phone from the car, which to me now sounds like the height of sophistication. Yes. But now it's literally, we've got someone on board, we've got someone reporting on politics from 7 a.m. till 11 p.m. at night. We're doing sort of 15 or 16 stories a day across print. We've spent most of my time in this job has been basically merging. Well, the first thing I had to do really when I got the job is merging the print and the online operation into one team. We were so much wastage of people that, one person would write the story for online and someone else would write it for the paper. Absolutely no point in that. Getting everyone into that thing. Yes. And at the same time, we're doing that now with video, and we're integrating the fact that every story needs video content, because 95% basically of our readers who are reading politics stories online are looking on their phone, and they'd often rather just have it told to them in 45 seconds in video than so people are consuming the news in an entirely different way, and that my job has completely changed in the fact that we've got to be A, fast, fair, correct, and number one all the time, regardless of platforms. So, people phone up and moan about things I tweet, but probably 1% of my content is on there. Most of it you'd never see.
Right. We are going to do some questions in a minute, but I've got some quick fire questions.
That's where it goes. When did you start dyeing your hair blonde?
It's quick. No, but it's worse than that. It's going to be quick fire questions from the book. So I was running around the park reading these. I think I've got to ask a question to us. So we're James' heavy favorite with this. What did Liz Truss get in her Shell graduate exams?
Oh, it was like B or
B minus, was it?
It was the second ranking, whatever it was, which was she was on her way to corporate glory, but not going to be the CEO.
What did Donald Trump write in the book?
Oh, good question.
To Liz Truss.
We're going
to
do great things or something?
Let's get a great deal.
Let's get a great deal. Beautiful deal.
It's.
What was the snack?
Oh.
That she
sticks.
What was the snack that Liz Truss had with her husband in 10 Downing Street when she decided she was going to stand?
Cheddar cheese and Sauvignon Blanc and pork pie, I think.
Yes, pork pie. Very good.
That is colour.
That is terrific.
Two people in the room. Who knew? How did we?
who leaves? What was in her rider?
No mayonnaise.
Absolutely no mayonnaise. Sushi.
My second question.
To put a Sauvignon Blanc in the hotel room without fail. Chilled. Bagels. Something about bagels. And she only liked the blue M&Ms.
That's not that. Pretty much, yeah. Quinton Letts described her new haircut as a cross between two politicians. Which politicians were they?
One was Thatcher?
No.
Michael Sambrican?
Yes.
Yeah.
And one slightly more famous.
Boris?
No. Hillary Clinton?
Hillary Clinton,
Can you tell us the story about Kwasi Kwarteng calling Alistair Jack, who is the Scottish Secretary at the time?
Oh, I love the story. In the presence of a great Chief Whip as well, this is a great story to tell. So it's about as Tory as you get. So the Chief Whip and someone else, but Alistair Jack, the Scotland Secretary, obviously were shooting on a Tuesday morning in their Range Rovers. And I'm from memory, I think Kwasi phones, this is when Boris is going down the Swanee, and Kwasi phones Alistair Jack, massively Boris supporting ally of Boris Johnson, and starts, they're in the Range Rover between pegs, and Kwasi's giving it, oh, mate, no, mate, Boris is fucked, mate, like, where's the lifeboat, what are we doing, you've got to get on board with Liz, yeah? And Alistair Jack just says very calmly, I disagree, Kwasi, and what's furthermore, I'd like you to know that you're on speakerphone and the Chief Whip's sitting next to me. and then very quickly, about 10 minutes later, I think Liz phoned back and was like, he wasn't speaking for me. I'm loyal. And then once the sort of sense of decay gets into a political party like that, that's when people start doing stupid things.
And a final question for me before we go to the floor for a couple, so get your questions ready. You genuinely probably got the political scoop of the decade with Matt Hancock and his aide. Just how does that come about? What's the process that you then go through? Like, give us the real details behind the story of what the job entails.
We're off the record, right?
Yeah, this isn't going to be broadcast anyway.
I'm afraid that is where we finish the recording here. If you want to come to future Jimmy's Jobs live events, just make sure you sign up to the Substack in the show notes below. And here's a final question that I posed to Harry and James on the future of journalism and what advice they would give young journalists.
Final question, piece of advice for aspiring young journalists. What should they be doing?
Always answer a ringing phone and don't go to journalism college. It's a waste of time.
Watch Harry Cole's talk on the tab on YouTube. And that actually, he's been very nice to me tonight. So I'll just say that was one of the reasons I became a journalist. So.